the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 242, Reformed.
Yeah, that's it. Reformed.
We're all reformed.
actually, our little podcast crew has been reformed back to our full complement of hosts.
That's
all
right.
All of us are here.
And that's
formed. Or would that be host-I? Hosts. Hosts.
Hosts.
Host-I. Whatever. Hosts. Anyway.
Host-day.
Yeah, so this is...
I'm Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
Phil Parada.
And Tom Lawrence. Who's turning off his phone?
Oh, okay. Good idea.
Tom's
that's right.
Playing on his so, phone. I thought we're podcasting over here.
I think we are. I may have to actually turn it off. This guy's gonna drive me nuts.
We were just talking about getting rid of technology by going on vacation. But anyway, so Phil's back with us, and so we're happy.
Back.
Yeah, we're happy to have you back, Phil.
And Tony's here for a whole show instead of the half
show.
That he jumped
right.
Yeah,
Tony was Tony was transitioning back. So
yeah,
I think he's fully
quite
assimilated.
A few shows too. And
yeah, you did. You did.
Yeah.
It's we the, noted. we took attendance.
Yeah.
That's all right, though. I think you were, part of your time you were in Italy.
Yeah, I was in Italy for a couple shows, and then my grandma died, so I was out
That's right.
for her funeral. And then now we're back.
We're back, and we're sassy.
And Phil was in Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone left the country.
I was in Japan and just got back from our honeymoon up north Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. I love going around Michigan. You know, it's
the third coast.
There's so much. Yeah. I mean, the Great Lakes.
3,000 miles
covered,
of shoreline.
We're surrounded by water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where Michigan is literally two peninsulas. There's mm-hmm. the upper yep. peninsula and lower peninsula. And you go east or go west, you hit water. And you go north, you hit water. So,
And it acts as a moderating influence. You know, when it's 100 degrees out west. Or,
oh,
you know,
they say it separates us from those crazy Canadians.
Yeah, that's right.
I was going to say, are you talking about weather Canadians. Or are you talking about political?
Yeah.
Yes, and you're listening to the Sunday Morning Geography Review.
Yes.
But,
all right.
But one of the big things Phil was saying that he did is lighthouses, because there's so much water and they're big freshwater basins or, you know, lakes, that there's lighthouses all over.
We
so, Phil, you said you guys took like a tour of lighthouses, huh?
Yes, we did. We drove up the east coast of Michigan above the Thumb. We cut 75 over by Bay City, and then I think there's something like 160, 170 lighthouses around all of Michigan because of our Great Lakes and all the ships that have to come through the Atlantic towards the St. Lawrence Seaway and then through the lakes up to the Sioux Locks so they can get to Chicago, Illinois, Wisconsin. It was awesome to see the different styles and sizes of lighthouses. And I wonder how much actual technology runs modern lighthouses of today. That's something that I want to look up and research.
Well, actually, just so you know, there's a documentary, and I got to meet the production person for the documentary that's produced a movie. Documentary is probably not exactly right. Docudrama, I think they call it. It's a reenactment of the life of the people that worked at the lighthouse and how it changed so rapidly when automation came in and took over the lighthouses. How they went from manned places that people lived to, within a matter of quickly years, that nobody lived there anymore. Everyone just automated the lighthouse. And it's coming out. And they did. They actually filmed a bunch of them here in Michigan. And I was actually on – I was a guest on another tech show, and that was the guest before me was that person. So I got to meet them and have a great conversation with them.
Very cool.
It was really interesting.
That is cool.
Mm-hmm.
She had a lot of time to question me because she's like, did you know how hard it is to film in 4K and edit? That was like – because they were producing this themselves. And she's like, I had to get a better computer. So it turned into a very technical discussion. Yeah, yeah, because she'd produced movies before, but they'd only shot in 1080. And they said, oh, cool. So they rented like those Epic Red cameras and shot everything in 4K. So they're like, we want this to be a great film. And they're like, we didn't have enough memory to process anything. So like, we had to change the budget for the editor.
Well, it happens.
It happens.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's. What type of projects or open source activity, Tony?
You know what? I upgraded my own cloud a few months ago, and it changed the UI, and my news reader didn't like update with it, so I couldn't get to it. And then this morning, I'm like, oh, I wonder if I just type in news like, as the app thing in the URL. Then it worked. So I, now I know how to get to it. but the other thing with my own cloud is because I run it on my own server, I can put as much data on I want. And I took so many pictures on my trip, and then I convinced everybody else.
Are you
or I tried
in,
to convince
you're not
the
in
other people
terab-
on my trip.
You're not in terabyte territory, are you?
Well, I have 2 terabytes on there, and I'm using about 1.5 total.
Okay.
But not in...
But your pictures.
My pictures were close to 200 gigs of pictures.
Okay.
And that's 12,000 pictures. Between me, my wife, and 3 other people, took 12,000 pictures. And I uploaded, or I put it all on my own cloud, and then shared that with my class. So then whoever didn't get a picture of something they needed, then can just sort through and then see whose is what's and get it then.
Did you just put them up there? Did you tag them or any kind of organization to them? Or
I
does the
organize
system...
them by date.
Okay.
And then the date,
it's always, it's a handy
we all
way.
Had our schedule so we could know what date, where we were on what date.
Yeah.
But then I also put like the main site we went to.
Oh, cool.
You know, we went to Pompeii and Herculaneum.
Did you see those people that were frozen in stone?
I did. Yeah, it was actually pretty interesting.
Speaking of that,
you know how that happened? That's not actually people, by the way.
That's just the stone. The people are
no. Yeah. What it is
Tony, you're gonna I have this thought.
Ruin
I've had
the
this. Yeah, I've had this. You know, ever since I was a kid.
So what it is, and we're going into SMLR archaeological right now.
That's it.
We started with geography, so we can go to archaeological now.
All right.
What happened is...
Because I'm sure they use open source software in the determining of this.
Maybe. I don't know. Well, it was 180 years ago or something. A long time ago they did this. But it was 1876 or something like that is when they first started digging up Pompeii. So if you know, a quick little history of Pompeii and Herculaneum, everybody died there because of a volcano eruption. So one city, Herculaneum, got the lava covered the city and everybody died. And Pompeii died because of the ash and pumice and gases that came down on and rained on them. And everybody just died. They didn't die immediately, but, well, some people did, other people didn't. But the people, so they died like in place, you know, so they like kind of fell down and died.
Strike a pose?
Well, and, well yeah, they, you know, laid over or whatever. And then they, you know, hardened there and all the pumice around it hardened. There, because it was pumice, their air could go through and their bodies decomposed. So their bones were there, but nothing else was. But it
so
left
if you
a
shake,
cavity.
If you shake that, you'll hear the bone inside the pumice?
No.
I'm just asking.
No, I know. Let me finish my story.
Okay.
So it left a cavity where the body was.
Okay.
And then they, when they found the cavity, then they filled it with...
plaster?
With plaster. So what you see is plaster in the form of the actual body. And then they went through and cleaned it up.
Well,
and
clearly,
so
I'm not going there now.
So there was a dog. I think there was a child. And there's a couple other ones that we saw there.
Okay.
So it was interesting.
I bet it was.
So it's... and they still haven't fully excavated those cities.
Mm-hmm.
They're only about 80% done. And they said, well, we know everything we need, so we're not going to excavate anymore.
Okay. Great.
So, yeah. And so my whole trip was kind of like that. We went to 8 different archaeological sites and 4 different museums and 20 restaurants with wine and pizza. And
how's the pizza there?
So it was really good. It's very different from what we have here.
Yeah.
What we have here is Americanized. And
yes.
It's basically people, I guess the story I heard is people coming across from.
Do they fold it like they do in New York?
Yeah.
They
yeah,
do, right? I when I lived in New York, I would go, you could buy it by the slice and you get it on these thin paper plates. I would fold my pizza.
Yep.
I would then elevate one end of it and let the grease drip off before I started eating it.
Well, you didn't buy it by the slice. You bought whole pizza.
A whole pie.
And the personal ones were, you know, so big. One of those was that 9 inches, 10 inches. And the majority of them are margarita pizzas. which is pretty much cheese and sauce. You know, it's a cheese pizza. And they're all like thin crust. You don't get as thick crust as what we have around here.
So when they say Margaritaville, it's just a different, whole different thing over there.
Well, that's liquor. Margaritaville is in Vegas.
All right.
No, so margarita pizza, you know, like margarita sauce.
Yeah, I think it's basil leaves and tomato. And, yeah. And cheese. I mean,
yeah,
but it's
pretty
not.
Much. And then there's a few things you can get on. Like if mm-hmm. you go to the restaurant, they don't fold it. You know, they serve it to you on a plate. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to, if you buy it from one of the street vendors, then it's folded up and you walk around. You get this paper, you know, they fold it and fold it in half again. So you're walking around with a quarter and then you're just like chewing off it as you walk around.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was good stuff. It really was good. But there's no pepperoni. They don't have pepperoni there.
Tony, you're shattering my whole Italian experience.
I saw one restaurant had spicy salami, and that was closest thing to pepperoni. Nothing else had pepperoni.
Now, did they have pineapple on the menu at all?
Yeah.
Or the pizzas?
And Canadian bacon and pineapple?
There was a few. It wasn't Canadian bacon, but it was, they called it bacon, and it was more stringy, hamish kind of
Yeah,
pork.
Bacon's only bacon in America.
Yeah.
And other places do not have our bacon.
Did you know that, speaking of that, we are so off topic, did you know that pork belly futures have gone up because of the demand for bacon?
Mm.
The commodity? Yeah, pork belly futures. I'm just sharing that, that's all.
All right.
All right, well, I think, why don't we just make an abrupt turn and get back.
Topic?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so Tom, we know you're usually good for some Somewhat. Interesting projects
I'll
and things.
I'll start with my off topic. Which right. is, I have a thing for classic. I sold my motorcycles and I just been bicycling in, but I have a thing for classic motorcycles, so I actually bought another one. So my friend, he has 63 of them, and he wanted 64, but he didn't have room in his garage, so he collects classic motorcycles, and he had one of them I wanted, mm-hmm. and he snagged it from a guy I seen it for sale, and he right away went and bought it like a year ago. But he goes, you know, I don't really ride it, and he goes, you want it? I think you'd ride it. I said, it's great. So now I have one of those, and I've been riding the hell out of it, which is fun. It goes back to that relaxing thing we were talking about before the show, how you got to find different ways to zone out. Zoning out on a motorcycle in the woods is kind of fun because it's off-roading. Anyways, back to tech-related, we built a new FreeNAS box for ourselves here, and we also did some FreeNAS torture testing. So you can't post things on the internet without making someone on the internet angry. And so we built, this is fact.
Don't tell me this is going to be an interesting story.
So we have some haters on YouTube because I built a FreeNAS server and I didn't use ECC memory. And you're like, oh, you have to, because if one bit were to flip in the memory and an ECC didn't catch it, you would corrupt your entire ZFS data pool. And we're like, oh, yeah, I've been to Michael Lucas's talks. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. Because it's a journaling file system, there's mm-hmm. a forever checksum system. So anytime new data, it's a COW file system, copy on write. So every time new data is written to it, it does a checksum of all the previous data to make sure the bits line up. And I don't have the exact number, but it's roughly 2 to the 56 to the 11th power of chances that the CRC checksum on a bad bit would actually match and allow it to write the data. So people don't believe that and don't understand the math behind of how ZFS works. So what we did was we built an old server with ZFS. Only one level of redundancy, so we did RAID Z1, and we kept randomly popping the memory out while it was writing. Like, we took memory out of the board.
Oh, really?
And we just destroyed this machine. And shockingly, every time we popped the memory out, pulled controller cards and everything, and just powered it down randomly, ZFS recovered every single time.
Wow. Impressive.
So there's one impressive. And it's only a RAID Z1, so there's only one parity of redundancy in there. The other thing that we did as part of the further torture test was just see how much of a file. So like when we're writing the files, we've seen how many seconds, because what ZFS does is it creates what they call the L2 arc, which is the memory cache. And it puts all that data in memory and then writes it back out, which is, of course, the ECC fear that people have. So what we learned is if Linux or Windows and it says, I'm done copying the file, if you pull it out the same second it says it's done, sometimes you do lose just that file that was copied. And the reason why is because it just hasn't finished getting it out of memory, and the memory's now in my hand and not in the motherboard. But the fact that it recovered was really the bigger point. So we recover everything up to that point. It's extremely hard to break
So I'm actually going to be doing some follow-up videos to explain ZFS in depth to people, how the journal system works, how copy on write works, and it'll be a shorter summary of the two books.
ZFS on Linux.
Yeah. FreeBSD.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. You said FreeNAS.
Yeah, FreeNAS is FreeBSD based. But the resiliency of the file system is, once again, proven.
Robust.
It's not that easy to break. So, but we someone had a couple other more torture ideas that we're going to do with it. The other thing people don't realize with FreeNAS, rearrange the cables. That's actually something kind of interesting that people don't understand about how it works either. I can take all the drives out of my arrays and rearrange them in any pattern I want. It doesn't use the ADA0, ADA1 to identify drives at all. ZFS recognizes it, not even by the controller, but by a signature on each drive.
Okay.
So even when we took the ZFS, popped the thumb drive out that we had loaded it on, popped all the drives and swapped motherboards, because eventually our final hoorah for the motherboard after we realized we couldn't corrupt ZFS, we took high voltage that we had.
I'm not surprised, Tom.
We started with the memory, and it did freeze up.
Was it arcing and looking like a science fiction, 1930s science fiction movie?
But after sending high voltage through it while writing files, once again it didn't corrupt, but we had another motherboard ready, so we swapped out the board and we plugged all the drives in, and it just boots up immediately. Now, I turn on a feature called AutoTune, which allows it to identify the hardware and optimize it. So when you first boot up a new hardware, it goes through, it tunes it, it reboots one more time, and it boots up in there. But it imports the volumes if nothing happened. That's the nice thing about ZFS. A lot of RAID controllers are specific to, they want, slot A, slot 0. They want the drive in the same place. Mm-hmm. ZFS, because it's using signatures on the drives to rebuild the pools, just doesn't care, which is also leads to us rebuilding our RAID array. We actually had acquired a really high-end SAS card that we're running ours on, and even though we started out using an onboard motherboard controller and now we're doing it across a SAS controller, there's no configuration change that I need to make for FreeNAS. I just plugged all the drives in, booted it up. And people are like, it won't work. I'm like, no, watch, it works. You can watch me power it down, rearrange the hard drives in a different order completely and do that, which we actually had to do because it turns out 7200 RPM drives in that new stack we got get a little hot. Mm-hmm. So we had to do the top. We had it all in one row. And then the next row, and we turned out they were too close to each other, so the drives got to an extreme temperature on the high side of the operating. So we actually have a row of drives, a gap, and another row of drives. And we're putting a series of laptop-size SSD hard drives in the middle row, because these are all full-size, to kind of create an air gap between there for heat.
Hmm. So did it get hot because you pulled too many fans out?
That was part of it, too.
Did you see any solder melt out of there?
Your attempt of lowering power usage?
Yes. It does not have the airflow because the old noisy power supplies, which we – it's right. I talked to him before the show. We had a problem because we had a friend donate a case to us. It's a 24-bay case or 24 hard drive case, and it had triple redundant power supplies, but they were really old and inefficient and idling without a motherboard connected. I think they were 112 watts or something, just idle and noisy, super noisy. And so we replaced it with a standard power supply, standard modular gold rated one, which is much more efficient. I think that pulls like 8 watts at idle. So the overall build is super efficient now, which matters. And we care about electricity and noise. And so I just don't have the redundant power supplies. They're not hot swappable or any cool. But that's mostly my open source stuff I've been working on.
One thing I want to say is that you've gotten a lot of flack for using consumer parts.
Yes.
And not like server ready.
Yep.
Well, this is what you're running in your own place.
Yeah.
It's not what you would put in a customer's place.
That's correct. I'm running at my own place, but I also do this kind of as I think more of the people who are watching my videos are home users who don't have the budget to just to go grab server and enterprise hardware.
Yeah.
It's really nice when we have clients with budgets that allow us to do that. But we built a somewhat consumerish 36 terabyte array for a client. They just don't have the budget to build it on regular server. So, this build cost them about $3,000 using consumer hardware. To build this on the enterprise with redundant power supplies and everything else, it would have easily cost them in a $10,000 to $12,000 range.
Yeah, you're looking at $200 or $300 per SAS disk, depending on the size.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So by building this, and because of the nature of the business, and this is what people don't understand, some companies aren't that big, they can't afford it, and they just need something large enough to store a whole lot of archival data.
Well, that matter of fact,
We replaced, yeah, or a lot of photos. And
we sorry, Tony.
And we replaced a NAS box that was getting full, but it was so old it only had a 100 meg connection on it. So, yeah, they weren't even running gigabit. I mean, it's just the way the nature of the company. And if the server were to die and it is backed up, we actually are using the old NAS for, so we've got the data duplicated on site and it's backed up off site. They can wait a day or two for a part. They don't need this super high availability. People think that they're some like these .com companies. Like, no, no, they just are archiving footage of sewers. That's actually what this holds. Lots of videos that are archival footage of sewers. And when an inspection comes up, they need to pull up. Yeah, oh, there's okay. every joke you can make about yeah. this.
Which it's, we won't.
There's a lot of crappy data on there. You know?
If they ever lose the data, it's all gone down the drain anyway.
It's all gone down the drain. Oh, yes. So, you know, there's circumstances where that, you know,
that
they
was
need.
Funny, Phil.
Yeah. They don't have the high availability man, so yeah. But, and that's why a lot of it, you know, our own stuff. Mm-hmm. We have technicians here, so that can swap a power supply. We have a spare power supply sitting in the rack in the cage. So if for some reason a FreeNAS box doesn't power on anymore, they can do it. But the other reason for running consumer hardware is you can swap out consumer hardware. It is on my shelf here. So if the motherboard were to explode, it's FreeNAS. It doesn't care what motherboard you use. Just swap it. Plug the card in, and you're back up and running.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's the redundancy of it. You know, I think there's a lot of people who want to build their own home labs and stuff, and it's kind of more of the audience we have on our YouTube channel, except for the guy who hates me that for I didn't use server equipment or ECC, and he can't wait till it what did he say? I can't wait till it explodes in your face so I can see it. You better do a video when it fails.
If he would like to donate and be a friend of the show, please.
Please.
Accepting enterprise quality gear.
Yeah.
Right.
As a donation. Yeah. So that's my foray into open source stuff that I did. And all the other little projects. But
all the little stuff. Sure.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I really don't have anything to report because I was on vacation. So that's quick.
I've switched my Apache server over to a web server called Caddy, C-A-D-D-Y. Hmm. It sets up. Setting up a vhost is about 5 lines of config rather than...
Does it use PuTTY? Did you have to get it? I know it's a nonsensical question, but
yeah.
I was going for the, okay, the golf
I gotcha.
Reference. Yeah.
Setting up a vhost is about 5 lines of config rather than like 20 lines of Nginx or 100 lines of Apache.
Oh, you mean how you take and you kind of not parse out, but you can purpose that Apache instance into a bunch of little virtual.
Yes, exactly.
And so that's.
So I can have example.com and example.org and whatever.example.com.
And how many lines is that?
It's about 5.
That's pretty nice.
Most of that is just filler braces.
Yeah.
It sets up your website with a Let's Encrypt certificate automatically.
Mm-hmm.
It will renew the certificates for you automatically. It configures HTTP 2.0 protocol, and it's just extremely slick. Through the logs, I've seen people pointing their DNS at my server, so I've taken it upon myself to provide them with a template website telling them to fix their DNS. And then I'll email these people, but I've got a couple free domains out there right now.
Okay, so the better joke would have been, so I could host some golf sites on there, blah, blah, blah. All right, so, okay, that, all right, all right. Okay,
it's
I'm going to laugh at it. No one else will, but
I
get
all
it?
Right.
Get it?
Golf caddy.
But, well, that's pretty interesting because I think one of the things, I've played around with Apache before, and I think one of the little challenges I had was trying to get that part of it all set up right, but this sounds much more straightforward.
It is. It's written in Golang, which is Google's programming language, as opposed to Apache, which is C or C++.
Okay.
But they're both super fast. Apache is tried and tested, but I've not been having a problem with Caddy over the past few months that I've been running it. And I'm an Apache guy at heart, and it was a breath of fresh air.
That's
trying
cool.
a new
yeah,
web server.
Yeah.
It says, you said it sets it up by default with the search,
yes.
right?
All you have to do is say TLS on, and if you want to provide an email to get notifications that, hey, your certificate's getting close to expiration, that's another line that says email and then your email address. Mm. And then it's just smooth sailing automatic from there. Wow. And you don't have to worry about it.
That's cool.
You know what? And you remind me, and sometime soon I should have you look at our Let's Encrypt on our...
Sure. I would be glad to.
Yes. The same server that you'd fixed it for that one time, which is about the same time Let's Encrypt had some issues.
You know, what I'm interested in, is we talked about it a few shows ago, is the wildcard search.
Yeah.
Soon.
Yes.
I'd be really interested in that because I have a few internal sites that are, you know, web servers in my house that don't touch the internet. So, and I want to be able to have those with a good cert on it.
Yes.
I believe that's going to be coming out with the Acme version 2 spec. Slated for January 2018.
We covered it in our last show.
All right, cool.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's yeah cool. We were like, we really wish Phil was here because this is exciting, and Phil likes Lex Encrypt. So,
was that just the two of us?
Yeah,
that show. Oh
yep.
Yeah.
So
yep. Tom and I soldiered on,
and then I came in halfway.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, Tony. You did join us in process.
My alarm
yeah.
never went off.
But, yeah, we have the same thing. We have a bunch of internal sites, and it would be just really handy to just blanket them all with a wildcard. So.
Cool. Yeah. I just tweeted the Caddy server out to my 74 followers. All right. Well, that sounds pretty good. So
74, that's 70 more than I thought you had.
Some of them may be bots.
I'm pretty sure at the last time we talked about it, you said you had like 4 or 5
followers. I have 78 now.
Ooh. So.
You know, I'm starting to gain some, but it's really interesting because I just never tweeted, and I've had the same account for years. I just read. And mm-hmm. But now, because a couple of the companies like my videos, like Unify, they started retweeting out my videos. So the people I do have on my following are retweeting. The guys from pfSense, the engineers at NetGate, mm-hmm. some of these big companies.
Oh, great.
That's pretty impressive.
I know.
Excellent, excellent. So don't when you put a new video together, you don't tweet that out?
I do.
Oh, you do.
And
I'm sorry,
they're retweeting it now.
Okay.
Yeah, and they're
gotcha.
Now they're retweeting my videos, which is exciting.
Yes.
So. Yeah, once that's where I got a ton of subscribers from. When the corporate company Unify, they're huge. When they started retweeting a project video, I was like, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you see the hits coming. You're like,
Tom, what's your
yeah?
What is your Twitter handle?
Tom Lawrence Tech, at Tom Lawrence Tech, which you'll find. I have to show Phil this, and you guys, do you see what it says on the screen here? Sweet oh cron instead of sweet corn. So I couldn't help but add some humor to that. Like, make sure you have the right kernel version. Just, I'm hoping other people jump on this. And then I said,
shucks.
And I, well, then I put in, you know.
We're on a treacherous path this morning, gentlemen.
Then I put 00:// /user/bin/getcorn. Mm-hmm. And add butter colon.
Those sound like they could be PowerShell commandlets.
Yes. But make sure the kernel version is correct. Yeah.
That was the cron line.
Yes.
To be able to run it. It's 00 is what, run it all the time?
Well, I mean, run it at midnight.
Oh, at midnight.
Okay. Yeah. I'll eat my corn at midnight.
Every day. Yeah, every.
Eat corn every day at midnight.
All right.
I see nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Mary's giving us the
yep.
sign.
I'm giving us the collective hook because we need to move on to probably our next segment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What is
before,
our next segment?
Before noon hits. All right. So we're going to move on to
listener feedback.
We want to hear from you. Call 734-258-7009 or email show@smlr.us with your feedback and questions.
We had a few emails recently. Where'd they go? What do you guys
We had Kevin O'Brien. I don't think we talked.
I thought you guys did talk.
Oh, you know what? Maybe we did. I had to look over the day of the show.
Let's
yeah.
See.
He just said he subscribed to my YouTube channel for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
He already follows my shenanigans on Facebook, so why not on YouTube?
Oh yeah.
I apologize for this one. I don't have my computer in front of me.
That's
I also
right.
haven't checked my email.
We also
why
have.
Why would I check?
Because Phil's been gone.
Yeah, and then we did have some feedback, and this is when we were talking about. I think I had referred to tiling window managers.
Yeah.
And we had some feedback from Charles.
Can we read it?
Well, you can. Go ahead.
Yeah, great show. I listen a lot.
Can you say that again? What was that? Great.
Great show.
Okay.
Yeah, we can say that part twice. Yes. Thank you very much, Charles. I listen to a lot of Linux boxes. Don't often hear tiling windows brought up, and just wanted to throw a little feedback in your way regards to tiling window managers. I have run many distros over the years, used many different desktop environments with them. I went with GNOME a long time ago, then switched to KDE and have been fine with both. But now my main desktop runs Arch Linux with window manager, is that i3?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
With no desktop environment installed and could be happier with my current setup. And he's got a few other details of some of the things, some of the tools he runs in there. But thank you very much. Yeah, we're tiling window managers.
Yeah.
So.
You know, and I responded to him, too, because I wanted to mention to him the awesome window manager, which I was very impressed with. I did a review. You remember, Tom, this was before you joined, and certainly, Phil, before you joined the show, but you remember a couple years ago I did that review on Aubion?
Yeah.
You know, and of course, we had the requisite jokes about the name, just fun little play on words. But it was a combination of Debian with the awesome window manager, and I really like that window manager because it was enough for someone like myself. You know, I don't just sit there and do server admin all the time. I mean, I'm an end user too, but it had enough end user type of features that really made it interesting for me. But it wasn't one of those big, you know, GUI KDE type things. I mean, I love KDE, but when you're handling servers, well, you know how it is, Tom and everybody. You just need to get some jobs done. And you don't need to have all the bells and whistles. You just and so that awesome window manager really filled the bill, I thought. So
I agree. I know a Ubuntu developer, and he used awesome at the time, and he was just showing how it worked, and it looked really nice. You know,
yeah.
if I was more into developing or even sysadmin, like watching logs and stuff, I would be all about it.
Mm-hmm.
But because that's just not my workflow, I didn't really
You're a Minty
move
guy.
Forward it. That's right. Yeah, well, and so now what I do is I just add monitors. I have three monitors at home now.
Well, Phil's you're a big Tmux user, aren't you, still?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
So I will take my crafted Tmux config that's available on GitHub. We can post a link later, and I can break apart my screen that stretches across my 27-inch monitor, my terminal screen. So I can have my own, I guess, virtual tiles inside of one terminal session, I want to say.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it, too.
I'm trying to get a picture of that.
Well, wow, tiling is where you can have multiple windows across your screen, and you can do that with Tmux is basically tiling your command line windows. So, yeah, terminal windows. Mm-hmm. And I use it, too. I use it through Byubu.
Okay.
And Ubuntu, and I love it. Yeah, I use it all the time.
For anyone who's never heard of Byobu or Tmux, GNU Screen is very, very similar.
Yeah, I use Screen, but I don't spend as much time developing like you. I've played with Tmux, so it's very cool. I need to stop and learn it, but I'm not in it enough to use it.
Right. You know what I liked about Byobu is you can switch between Screen or Tmux.
Ah.
And it's just one set of commands you learn, and it will do a translation between them if you want it.
Oh, cool.
So I don't have to, like, know the difference between Control A for a screen or Control or whatever for the Tmux. It just does them. You know, you do, there is a set of commands you learn, and I'm pretty sure they're the same as the screen commands. But you can, in the config, you can just say use Tmux instead, and then it'll do it all for that.
Oh, cool. Because I had to hack mine up to get it to behave like screen. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. What other feedback?
That's all I have. Well,
you,
Mary,
you replied, but you basically just said.
Yeah, I said what I did. Yeah.
I guess I could count this as feedback. Internally on LinkedIn, and Bharat had told us, this is the guy who coordinated us for the Microsoft. He seemed excited about because I sent him directly a link to all the shows because I hashtagged him the MS Build podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent a link to all the shows. They said they're really happy. They're excited about them. But on LinkedIn, some of the people he interviewed were resharing it and had a little comment that they were really excited. They liked the way the interview went and things like that.
Good,
so
good.
They didn't reply to us, but it's on the LinkedIn when they reshared it. So I guess it's kind of a feedback from our Microsoft stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of the
through.
I'll
have to look that up.
Yeah, well, he'd asked, and I just replied directly to Bharat, and he said, "Oh, thank you, awesome." So
yeah,
he just wanted a link to all of them because once we had them all published.
Oh, sure, that makes sense.
Yeah,
Yeah. So
and because we tagged him with MS Build Podcast, I just sent him. You can use it on our website. You can add that.
Oh, and Twitter right. Well, or LinkedIn. Okay. I remember tweeting at that Build conference, and I loved it because my handle is Linux Girl. Yes. Let's make sure that Linux flows through there. Which I was able to get back in 2009 because Twitter was, I mean, it was out there, but, you know. So, all right.
Yeah.
So we, I guess, so have no other feedback.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's feedback or what if we want to
say.
That's
what Tom said, Tony.
We were invited to a couple more of the Microsoft conferences.
Yes.
Yeah, they were they were happy with how that went.
They want to do some more interviews.
With some of the things that are happening that are related to Linux from the Microsoft.
I think that's interesting because I've seen people like, oh, you don't, you know, you shouldn't, you're going over to the other side. You know, you hear all the commentary.
No way.
But yeah, exactly. I mean, do you not want someone with opposing views? That's what makes it interesting. We believe things one way. Mm-hmm. They see things a different way. Why would we not want to have a discussion with those people?
And you know, the other thing, too, is that even though some of the tools that they're introducing are taking some Linux things and putting them into the Windows world, I think it's an opportunity for people who might might use Windows only or might be kind of a Windows sysadmin to sample some of these things and see what's happening over in the Linux side. But I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's a lot that both sides can learn from mm-hmm. each other.
I think so. And I think, I know, Tom, you've said it before, the new, he's not so new anymore, but the Microsoft CEO, he's made some pretty major changes.
Yeah, and I think that's just, it's a concept when you start dealing with very large corporate companies to realize it's not at all easy to change them. Mm-hmm. Satya Nadella, even the power he has, he does report to an executive board, so he can't say, any of these lawsuits we got going to Linux, just stop them all. All right, cool. All right, we're good. No, the board would go bye.
Yeah, right. And I know in the next that next conference they've got, I think the one of the focuses is going to be on SQL Server on Linux.
Yes.
And so, and I think the interesting thing about that is because I can remember from my old company where you know they were so Microsoft centric, but now you know it seems to me that you can have that solid Linux server underneath and then put this product on here if it offers some additional features that maybe MySQL or MariaDB doesn't happen to offer. But of course they have their own set of features that maybe aren't in Microsoft's SQL server. I think the big thing is choice.
The big thing is choice, and the other thing too is, like it or not, Microsoft's one of the top contributors on GitHub right now. Mm-hmm. They're dumping lots of code. They have lots of skills. They have a great programming team there. Whether you like what they're doing or not, they do have some very smart people working there. Mm-hmm. They're dumping it on GitHub, and like Red Hat did, oh, look, .NET Core is completely open source. We're forking it because we don't really want you guys in control of it, so we want to make our own version, and they completely forked it, and that is the concept of open source. Microsoft's learning that because no one's trusting them to maintain the project, mm-hmm. but press the fork button and fork it. Yeah. I mean, just... Yeah. So it's and that's something we really like to see.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'll always say this: if you sit me next to a Windows desktop and a Linux desktop like KDE Neon, I'm over on the Linux side.
Oh yeah, all of us are.
So.
So.
All right, but we just wanted to mention, that there may be some other interviews coming down the path.
Yeah.
Fresh looks. So.
That's right.
More fun stuff. Hey, why not?
Yeah.
We gotta hear from the other side. We can't just make fun of them and not let them on the show.
Yeah, no, but they're, you know, meeting them individually, just pretty interesting people.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I guess we're going to move on to...
Moving on to what distros are next.
Distro Fever, where we cover the latest hot distro releases and news.
You know, it's been so long since I've listened to that intro or that little soundbite.
You said the wrong name.
I did.
I noticed that.
Distro Fever.
Yeah, you were in a fever. but anyway, I had a chance to peruse the list, and sometimes I think when summer is upon us, people, you know, Tony, you can attest to this. People go on vacation, and so there's not as many updates to to different distros and things, but right. I will say this: I noticed that Magia 6 came out.
Ooh, did it hit the list?
It's on what list? Oh, you mean the list on the right, the top?
Yeah.
No.
For the last 7 days.
No, it didn't. But try for the for the last 7 days, it might have. But anyway, the reason my reason for mentioning this is I've decided I have never, I don't think I've ever done a distro review of Magia, have I?
I don't think so. No, it's at number five right now, just for the last week, because of its release.
Because of the release. So I am going to do an upcoming Fresh Looks episode. I am going to take a look at Magia.
All right. So if we have any new listeners or listeners from the last few years who have just come on,
we had some,
and Phil, maybe you don't know what you're talking about.
We used to have fun with Magia.
Yeah. Well, what is on the right side of DistroWatch? They have like the top five or the top whatever page hits for the different distros.
For different periods of time.
And it's the hits for the DistroWatch pages for each distro. And so that we would watch, you know, Mint was always, and the Mint, Debian was always, you know, toward the top, in the top five, like always. And there was a period of, what, about a year that Magia was number one. And we were
skeptical. Yeah, it was up near the top, if not the top.
Right, we were always skeptical and thinking. And then all of a sudden, one day, it just dropped off and had never really recovered since then. So I don't know what happened with that.
But yeah, so we used to kind of joke around about it, and we thought they were, you know, bot monkeys that were
bots
hitting distro watch to pump that up. But
right.
But anyway, no, so I'm going to be taking a serious look at it. So anyway, that's, you know, as far as what we see on the list here, that was, you know, my contribution. And then I saw that, oh, by the way, too, Deepin, that's that Chinese distro. They've been around for a few years. Used to be Highweed. Remember that? I think it was Highweed.
Weed? Something like that. Deep, I don't know if it was Weed.
Deep Weeds. Well,
it was High something.
Yeah, I thought it was Weed.
Actually, it should say on there.
Sorry, short-term memory's gone right now.
yeah. But anyway, so that they've got a new one out. I've always been impressed with how well packaged that is. And by packaged, I'm just talking about how well the whole distro is put together as a user experience, because I have downloaded it and checked it out. And I think I even did a distro review of it a few years ago. And so it was very, very nicely integrated. So,
I'm scrolling back all the way through 2004. And keep on going. It's always been.
Oh, tough. You know, what was that? Yeah. Deepin, formerly Highweed. Yes, remember we had all those jokes?
In 2004, it was Highweed-Deep Debian.
Yes, it was. It was called Highweed.
Actually, and I don't remember that for some reason.
I do. But anyway, it was, so Phil, for your edification.
Far out, man.
Yeah, yeah, it was kind of like that. Anyway, so those are the two that caught my eye.
Fedora 26 dropped last week or the week before that, so I've been slowly upgrading
Fedora 26.
My Fedora boxes. Yep.
Oh, really? Production version or just a release candidate?
Production version, I believe.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
I've still got some Fedora 24 boxes that need to get upgraded, but it should be pretty smooth sailing.
Mm-hmm. What happened to 25?
Skipped it completely. I don't remember.
Okay.
No, all right. Interesting features.
Was deep in.
All right.
I see Backbox is on there. Released yesterday? No. Today's the 23rd.
Just
or 2 days ago. Yeah.
They have a really nice website.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Why do you say that, Tom?
Go to their website. No, it's actually really cleanly displayed, all the stuff on there. It's not full of crap.
Fluff.
It's actually really easy to read. I clicked on it to see the new release. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what the website looked like. That's a trend I'm loving. A lot of these companies are making better websites, because it used to be Linux distros. Even up until more recently, their websites always look like the 90s still.
Yeah.
Oh, that is pretty slick looking.
Yeah. And it's got, and of course, more importantly, it has good information.
Oh, yeah. It has the standard ubiquitous three little columns at the bottom. That's some kind of theme. I see that on so many sites now.
My wife could tell me what that's called, but she's asleep right now.
Okay, yeah, don't wake her up. Yeah.
Right.
All right, so anything
else?
I'm
not sure what Backbox is. It's a security-related or oriented distro based on Ubuntu. So it's similar to Kali Linux. But
I wonder if anybody's done a comparison of those two.
I had planned at one point to do a comparison. I just hadn't gotten around to it.
Still think Kelly's the best one?
I've never used anything else.
Okay.
So I need to try it.
So it is.
And now that I'm finishing my master's degree, like I'll be done at the end of August, and maybe I'll have a little bit more time to work on something like this.
Actually, here's a fun idea. Well, we won't get too off topic. We want to have a Kali Linux get together here at my office. Want to take that?
Sure.
Probably fill
I think it'd be fun.
Sure.
Yeah, we'll have a beer pizza and Kali Linux, and we'll do some pen testing on my network.
All right.
I want to get like a few other tech.
Is this like, is it open to the public?
Yeah.
All right. So if you live in the area, contact Tom and let him know you want to come and we'll
and hack on
his
server.
It's happening.
Yeah. Well, I think we set some test servers up and all hang out. And
I think that'd be, and that'll make an interesting fresh looks, you know, as far as talking about what happened. Yeah.
You know,
it's your own personal CTF.
Yes.
Yeah. Capture the flag.
Capture the flag and eat some pizza. All right.
Or turn the pizza into a little flag. So that'll be good.
You gotta fold it.
A flag style pizza.
Well, like pizza? A pennant, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, a
pennant.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most pizzas would fall over, though.
Well, you have to do it right.
All right. We're off topic again.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we've got to get back on because we're over our time budget.
All right. I have one last distro-related thing.
Oh,
so if anybody happens to be running Docker and they have to, or any other container type tool, such as Rocket, and you are stuck on CentOS 7, there is a Yum repository I found called EL Repo, and they build the mainline kernel and the long-term release version of the kernel. So you can get kernel 4.12 that just recently came out on CentOS 7, which can help you use different features of Docker and maybe fix some bugs that were kernel-related in regards to containers. It's helped me out.
That's cool.
Great.
Very cool, yeah.
I'm sure it's going to help somebody else out. Oh, you know, one thing, when I said I was on vacation and didn't do anything, I did one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I have an Amazon AWS account, you know, for S3 and, you know, all the little Amazon tools.
Yeah.
I went ahead and set up an Azure account.
Uh-oh.
just to do it.
You're going to run Linux in it?
Heck yeah. Heck yeah. Nothing but.
Yeah, I'm going to have a story about that. I set up an Azure account, too, and I'm confused. I'm going to be talking to salespeople to try and sort it out, but it's a little bit different than I expected setting up an Azure account.
Do they have a command line so you don't have... Okay.
You can run Bash right inside there. That was actually at the keynote.
Yeah, you can run it from Bash or from PowerShell.
Okay.
Yeah. My confusion is I can't spin up any, even though I have a $200 I have in the account.
Yeah.
It won't let me spin up any servers without also signing up for an MSDN license for all the servers. Except for Linux. You can run Linux servers. So,
oh, yeah.
Well, then, there you go. That's all you should run then, Tom.
I'm going to test with server 2016 instances because they have a project. So.
Oh, and so if you're trying to spin up a Microsoft server, you've got to do the licensing.
We're looking at hosting.
Well, I guess that makes sense from a licensing perspective.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other topic. We'll do
it's a whole.
That might be a fun show, though. Maybe some listeners close this. We do review some of the AWS, which Phil's very adept at, and we talk about what it's like to host in some of those environments like AWS or Google or Azure.
Does Azure have their own form of DNS management like Amazon has Route 53?
They have an entire software-defined networking stack. I haven't really used it, but
I wonder if they support DNSSEC and DANE. That would be interesting. Because right now, Linode does not. And that's probably going to get me to leave Linode. Ah, well.
Let's move on to the news.
All right.
All right.
Tech news and views.
So news. So who's got some news they want to talk about?
You know, my goal, I want to preface the news, but my goal is always to try to find something that Tom hasn't found.
Oh.
I do. When I sit down in front of my workstation, I think, okay, Tom's out there finding news. He's got that little app that allows him to read it at incredibly fast speeds. So he does that because half the stuff I come up with, Tom has. That's okay. And that's perfectly all right. This is more of a humor thing, Tom, of course.
You know what else you could do is if you go first, then Tom can't talk about it. Then who knows who came up with it first?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
You probably read the articles
Yeah, you probably have. And actually, this one is probably about a week and a half, 2 weeks old anyway, but it had to do with the you didn't talk about the DRM being approved for W.
It's in my show notes for now.
See? All right, well, good, Tom. We'll go ahead and talk about it.
That was extremely cryptic.
What was that?
That was extremely cryptic.
But that's all we needed.
Oh.
Yeah, that's all we needed. What happened is that, let me just pull up the...
Go ahead and start it. Yeah,
go ahead. But you're talking about DRM and...
Yeah, W3C had approved it for HTML5.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, there were a lot of people... What? Yes, yes.
Oh,
there
this
were a
goes
lot,
worse.
A lot of people who were opposed to it, including the EFF.
And it's scary who's not opposed to it.
Well, I will not be the least bit surprised when you tell us, Tom, who's not
the guy who invented it.
Oh, Tim Berners-Lee.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's for it. He's got some commentary on it, so he's for it, but mm-hmm. he has some reasoning behind it. But still, the EFF has a much better perspective on it, mm-hmm. Which I enjoy. So, and I think there's a little bit of history we can talk about with...
Just to comment on Tim Berners-Lee, he just didn't think that the objections were substantial enough, according to the article I saw, yeah. to warrant it not being part of the standard, which... I don't know who prepared the objections, but they didn't work hard enough, darn it.
There's plenty of angry people now.
Mm-hmm. I've got my table-flipping emoji going right now.
Oh, I know. Well, and and one thing is about DRM that, you know, let's go all the way back to MacroVision. Do you remember MacroVision at all?
I remember the name.
So MacroVision was back in the VCR days, and it was a tool to prevent you from copying VCR tapes. Uh-huh. And it lowered the quality. It not as a tool, but just in general, it lowered the quality for paying users. But there was all these MacroVision defeating things. Then we had the DVD, and it was all the DVD. And then we had HDMI, which has the HDCP protocol in there. And you can go buy really inexpensive HEPC removers. And those are finicky, and I've had people had problems getting your TVs get connected because of problems with the protocol and the way it connects to the TV, and you can't play content. Like, the only people who have suffered with DRM has consistently and absolutely been the consumers who don't crack it. Because we know how to crack it, we go, oh, yeah, look, they added something that I can bypass in like 2 seconds for a mm-hmm. little $10 adapter. So it's the people who want to copy movies have never suffered. The general public always suffers from DRM. That's my take on it. And I'm like, that history should tell you all this is going to do is create some more complexity for people to suffer, that the hackers are going, yep, I can crack this in 2 seconds and bypass it, and we can still get all the things that you're trying to protect from. So it's never provided adequate protection and has ruined user experience, like, in all of history of DRM.
Not just in videos, but in video games as well.
Oh, yeah, everywhere.
There are single-player games that you have to be connected online to play. That's yes. ridiculous.
I hate that.
Yeah.
And I don't play them.
I'm looking at you, EA.
Yes, EA is one of those companies. So, yeah, it's... It's not a good thing. So we're all going to protest it.
Mm-hmm.
Phil's flipping tables and
yeah. You know,
donate to the EFF. Make a rant about it. We're talking yeah. about it to make you guys aware. We do not mm-hmm. want DRM in the new spec.
No,
it's useless. It's pointless. It'll only ruin user experience.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that was really my big news. The other thing I wanted to mention too, and this almost falls into KDE Corner, but I'll just quickly mention it. You know, one of the text editor I really like is Kate, and they just released Kate for Windows.
Hey, cool.
Yeah, they did. Mm. They did. So
well, that's cool.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's fully featured as fully featured as the Linux one is, but. I think it'll be pretty interesting to give it a try in Windows because I do plan on installing it. They've got you can get a 32-bit download for install, or you can get a 64-bit download for install. You know, those EXE files. Remember those?
Yeah. Right.
but yeah, so I think that's kind of interesting, and I'm going to give it a little spin and just see what's the same and what's different. You know, that might be a good project for me for next time.
All right.
Okay, so those are the two items I have for news.
Do you want me to run through my list next?
Yeah, go ahead, Tom. Sure. Since I would have had no list. Oh, no, I would have had Kate. You didn't have the Kate
I
one.
I did not. You got me.
All right.
I didn't even know they were. That's cool.
Yeah.
Because I'm excited. Like the Kate and Live project, they ported it over to Windows. And there are a couple of iterations into it. So I was going to do some testing because a lot of people ask me about video editing but aren't running Linux. I'm like, Kate and Live has a Windows version. I was told it crashes a lot less now on Windows.
Okay.
It's super solid on Linux, but they've been working on that. Back to the news. Millions of IoT devices hit by the devil's ivy bug from an open source corollary. Apparently, they found a flaw in a library called GSOAP, and it affects tons of security cameras. And this another botnet created by security cameras. So, yeah, it's apparently quite the mess. And the big problem, especially around surveillance cameras, is nobody patches them at all, ever. And there are tons of them exposed to the internet. You know, we actually have a client that knows that there's a flaw in their security DVR system, and they won't replace it because it's too expensive. They just reboot it whenever it becomes a bot again because it won't let them access the web interface. And I'm like, it's sending out lots of...
They just reboot it when it becomes a bot again.
That's like the solution.
Oh,
I know.
Now, well, is there a certain port they can block, or is it just scan?
Because there's so many flaws within it. I mean, this is what shut down part of the D.C. In Washington, D.C., a huge part of the police network, because the vendor installed the same cameras everywhere, and no one patches the cameras, and it shut down lots of their surveillance. And it's been like an up-and-down battle of getting them patched, but the patch isn't very good. And then when they use these off-brand cameras, there's a lack of any patching. When we do, a proper security implementation for installing cameras, and we've done this at some of our larger clients, is you put them on a completely separate network that's not exposed to the internet and doesn't have internet access, because cameras don't need to get online.
No.
And there's, protocols, because we already know, we have one client, there's outdated Sonys they have that have firmware problems that there's no fix for right now, because they're old, but they work, but they're also on a separate network or no internet, and no one else can get on that network to infect them, so they're not at risk. But yeah, it's definitely a big problem. So here's something kind of fun. Subsurface-divelog.org. They released a new version, and it is a latest version of if you're a scuba diver, and it's for dive logging. And I think Tony's smiling because
trying to figure that one out.
Yeah, that was fun. That's a lot of fun.
And what famous scuba diver do you think?
Jacques Cousteau.
No, well, who do you think writes the software? And he's an avid scuba. Yeah, Linus.
Oh, I didn't know he was a scuba diver.
Yes. Yeah. And they did an interview with him in a magazine, ZDNet did. And he talks about his scuba diving and the latest version, which is actually pretty slick looking.
Wow.
And so for someone wanting a little trivia about Linus, when he's not ranting about someone submitting bad code to the kernel, he relaxes by diving.
That's funny.
When he's not deep diving into the kernel, he's deep diving in the sea.
That's a good one.
Now, this is kind of fun. There's it's repology.org, Repology. They keep statistics. And this is rather clever. And Mary's going to like this. FreeBSD comes out on top. And what these are is statistics for how fresh the repositories are. Mm. So whether or not they have the latest versions of things in there. And FreeBSD.
I'm kind of surprised at that. And I don't, that's no, not to reflect poorly at all on FreeBSD, but it tends to be. It always looked like it was a little bit behind as far as versions go. So, Tom, that's interesting.
Well, don't worry. There's still 20% of the packages are outdated.
Okay. Those are probably the ones I looked at.
But Ubuntu 17.10 even is at 22%, and Debian Unstable is at 23, Debian Testing is at 24, Fedora Rawhide at 22, and it dives downhill into 30% really quickly after that. So.
Oh, man. Where's Red Hat on that?
Fedora 26 is at 27%.
What's that website again?
repology.org/statistics.
Repology.
Repology. Yeah, I thought that was kind of neat, though, that someone's analyzing it. So that's pretty cool. Zero Phone, a Raspberry Pi smartphone. This is an updated open source project. And if you haven't heard about some of the zero-day stuff that's going to be released at Black Hat next week, it's really fascinating. We actually talked about it because the bug was reported and been patched by Apple and Google, which is an interesting Wi-Fi hack. Apparently, the kernel-level drivers are accepting commands even though you're not connected to that Wi-Fi network. So they can literally drive-by hack your phone by placing certain packets within the Wi-Fi that are out-of-spec packets, but your phone will then run them as commands. And it's no one's exactly figured out how these security researchers cracked this. They announced it almost a year ago that they had this information, and they did proper disclosure to Apple and Google to fix it. It affects the drivers in a few different wireless chipsets. And but so this is a bad thing, and they're going to release the details now that it's been patched. But, of course, it's only been patched for phones that are getting patches. But this made it interesting timing for a Zero phone, a Raspberry Pi smartphone. And I'll have a link in the show notes to all the details of step-by-step how to build your own smartphone with a Raspberry Pi that makes calls and everything. It's rather clever. All off-the-shelf parts. So,
you know, Jenny, my wife, is looking to get a new phone. We might go down this path. Build
your own phone?
Yeah, she uses a SIM card now. So she can switch to different providers.
There's a couple. There's one, I can't remember, it was our project, and I didn't have it in the show notes, but it's an open source operating system made for phones that's made for phones that are out of service. I can find the link and send it to you. But it's for older phones, but there's also people who do this for newer phones. So you can swap them over to Linux. Now, you lose a lot of the Android or Apple functionality, but you gain the, it's open source and cool. So pretty neat.
So, just so everybody knows, a Zero phone is like a candy bar style phone.
Yeah.
And all you do is make calls on it. There's no like smart to it.
Well, it's running Linux,
but
yeah. But it's no Ubuntu phone.
It's not a smartphone like Android.
Okay.
Okay.
Right. And even though even Ubuntu phone, which is kind of now an abandoned project, I think it's being picked up by some other people. Neat in concept, never really took off, and with a lot of people's dependency on some of the Google apps features and some of the things we're using on the phone, it becomes very difficult to switch. But
it does look really cool, though. I'm looking at the project right now.
The project.
it's a fun Raspberry Pi project, no matter what. Whether you actually use it, it's still fun to do because you can. That's the most important part. So I'm going to link to this. This was really clever. I found this morning. How to defend your website with a zip bomb.
Yeah, that was a fantastic read.
Yes. So this is really clever. Zip bombs are the fact that zip
I have not heard of that.
Well,
There's
what a zip bomb is you can take a massive, you know, 4 terabyte file, but the file is just a text file with zeros in it.
Oh, sure.
So you zip it, and it becomes like a few kilobytes.
Mm-hmm.
Because browsers and things like to go through and unzip things to unpackage and figure it in there, because gzip is built into the libraries of most of all the modern browsers, including when hackers are doing scanning. So if you plant the places that they're looking for, like your admin panel, things like that, and you plant zip bombs in there, it will just crash all the different things. They try to open it, and they just run out of memory because you just threw 4 terabytes at them.
Yeah, it's called the zip of death.
Zip of death. Yes.
Like so
that's cool.
Yeah, so the website works functionality-wise is perfectly fine, because it's only when people go somewhere they're not supposed to, they get handed a zip bomb. Like, if there you go, you just crash your scanner. And it stops the scanning tool from going any further, because it keeps crashing every time it tries to get through the page. So this guy planted zip bombs over his website.
As a matter of fact, this is from a Reddit thread back in 2012, but there was a zip bomb called 42.zip. It was only 42K when it was zipped, but once uncompressed, it was 4.5 petabytes.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So that was actually a common way.
And you're not referring to copy on write, are you, Tony?
No.
Yeah.
That was a way that we used to have to protect a lot of Exchange servers. And Indian firewalls used to have a proxy for Exchange. Some people really wanted to run Exchange servers internally before everything went to the cloud. So we used to put a proxy to filter all the mail that came in. And among the things we'd strip off is we'd strip off all the zip files and you can't take them anymore, because that would just dump the Exchange server right away.
And when you dump an Exchange server, you actually end up sometimes corrupting the entire Exchange database at the same time, because Exchange is a horrible, horrible product. And yeah, so it would just crash and like, oh, great, we got to restore from the last backup, which is a non-arbitrarily easy thing to do. Mm. So, yeah, zip bombs have been around for a long, long time. Yeah, it was like 15 years ago I was doing stuff like that to help protect people in Exchange. My protection now is not using Exchange.
Well,
it's interesting.
But just a quick question. When you're talking about creating it, so at some point there's a 4.5 petabyte or however big it is file. Is it a script?
Yeah, you can use a script to create it.
Which kind of streams this.
Yes.
Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, you can actually stream directly into the zip. Right. That's the solution to making the
these are huge files, because all you do is writing zeros, and mm-hmm. at the same time you're writing them, you're compressing them, so you would actually just pipe it right through. It may take a little while, because it has to put it through a pipe, but the
sure,
landing is,
sure.
You know, when it actually does the file write part of it, so.
And actually, the article I found said that some browsers don't understand zip, but they do understand gzip.
Yeah.
So you can, and it gives you the command in here. It's a DD command that you pipe into.
And that makes perfect sense.
Gzip
sure.
into the file, and it takes a 10 gigabit gzip file, or 10 gigabit, you know, file, gzips it down to 10 meg.
Hmm.
Yeah, so someone thinks they found a treasure trove of data. They did.
Right.
Wow.
GIMP. I started using GIMP. It's been.
Did we have a conversation about GIMP and you were not? Yeah, yeah.
I make emojis with it. It's very easy.
Once you're a Photoshop user, and mm-hmm. one of the things I've been watching a lot of GIMP tutorials, because one of my aggravations is with GIMP is everything takes about 6 extra, sometimes 20 extra steps that is a checkbox in Photoshop. This is, you know, Photoshop just automates a lot of the things. Which
sure.
But I've been learning it. Unrelated to that, but kind of related, GIMP has a metadata editor.
Mm.
Which is kind of cool. So now when you open up the files, you can start changing all of the data there. That's kind of cool. So it's still really actively developed. It's slowly learning it. So
you're starting to.
Well, yeah, I switched to using all my. I didn't want to have to keep spinning up a virtual machine every time I created a new thumbnail.
Sure.
To enhance my workflow, I don't spin up virtual machines anymore. I shoot the YouTube video. I grab the screen grabs out of the video with GIMP mm-hmm. and put them all together to make.
Well, you know, one thing, too, is I used to not like, well, GIMP was something I used, but the thing that used to bug the heck out of me about it is the fact that you have these multiple windows.
Oh, there's a checkbox.
Yes. And a few years ago, they came out with a version that you could just check the box, and it was automatically a single window with the panels on the left and right, and then your workspace in the middle.
So my search was GIMP tutorial for Photoshop users. And that's the first thing they tell you to check. There's that and the layer sizing thing, because the layer sizing is stupid by default. If you have one little object on there, when you try to resize it, it wants to resize the entirety of the layer. And I'm like, this makes no sense. I just want to resize the object. There's a box that you can check, so when you add a layer with one small object on the screen, which might be the logo of a company on there, mm-hmm. it only makes the bounding box that size. So those two checkboxes, one, consolidating the windows, two, that. Now it's actually very usable for me because mm-hmm. most of my time I'm not doing too many advanced things. I'm just grabbing a thumbnail. When I'm talking about FreeNAS, I throw the FreeNAS logo at the top of the thumbnail. But it used to make me resize the entire layer. And I'm like, it's just one little logo that's a very small piece of this.
Yeah, why go through all that?
Yeah, and it makes me have to zoom out to do it, to grab the little corner things. I'm like, this is dumb.
You know what I did is I actually removed my toolbar. And now I can't figure out how to put it back on.
Oh, there's a reset button for that because I completely broke toolbars multiple times now. And
all right.
They actually have a reset them because I was just going in the command line and just deleting the GIMP folder and just letting it recreate it in my own drive. That way I could just.
That's
I'm
one
like,
way
I don't
to
know
solve
when
it.
I broke it.
Yeah.
Then I thought there's got to be an easier way, and I read that.
That's
and I'm like,
that's
there's
like
a reset
rebooting
Windows
a Windows
checkbox.
Machine.
Yeah, just reboot it.
You know, the other thing they did too that I really appreciate, and this happened in a later version or update. Is when you were done with your work and you needed to save it as you had to export it. And there were several little things you had to go through to get it out of GIMP as a GIF or GIF file or a JPEG. And I think they've streamlined that a little bit now.
The export works really well.
Yes,
and it also remembers the last place you exported, which is convenient.
Very convenient. And I really appreciate that because it was bothersome to me to have to go and keep clicking into the folder I wanted to save. I'm saving, you know, doing work. And I wanted all my work in one folder, but I had to keep.
You don't think as much about it until you do a lot of repetitive things like I do when I'm creating videos. One of the things that the whole KDE Neon workflow helps with is
activities?
all those remembered paths. I don't care for activities.
Didn't we talk about that?
I did some testing with it. I was going to do a video on it. And if I could get it to stop crashing. I found all kinds of bugs and lockups, and it didn't work well for me. Anyways, and they're just well known. It's not like I had to do a bug report. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, one day maybe they'll figure this out. But what it does is remembers all the paths
pretty well to all kinds of things. So it remembers the last view I had in each folder. So when I go to a certain folder, which I go to all the time, it already remembers the view and sort order for each folder. That saves me countless time to do this.
I just crashed Plasma.
Good job, Mary.
I, Tom, you know, you're talking about activities, and I thought, to create one, and so I created more activity for myself as far as getting my it's mm-hmm. yeah. I still have certainly access to my browser, but I don't have my Plasma.
And mostly what I was going to use activities for was my video editing, and that's what it actually locks up Caden Live a couple times, which is that's a KDE project.
It
responds fine, but it was more aggravation. I may as well just open it rather than wait for things to keep crashing and responding. I started playing with a new DNS tool called DNS Thingy, and I like the name. It's really clever, and what caught my eye is they have a pfSense plugin. Now, everyone asks me this all the time. I do all these pfSense videos. They're like, hey, I want to filter all my network traffic and blah, blah, blah.
The problem is when you want to use things like Squid, everything's SSL now, and you have to do kind of your own man in the middle, which is a pain. I don't recommend it. You're compromising security. You're creating all kinds of headache of managing certificates, and then things like anything on your network, like your phone and other IoT devices, simply don't have options because you can't install the certificate on there, so you don't have to build your traffic. DNS filtering is the way to go. DNS thing. Because it has a plugin for pfSense, it allows you to manage all your internal devices. There,
nice.
You can tell your devices and put DNS whitelists and things like that in there. So you can say, this IoT only needs to do this or only needs to go here. So it gives you very restrictive all DNS filtering, website blocking, all kinds of fun stuff, like, you know, filtering out ads. It's not a free service because you're paying for the use of their DNS servers, but the plugin's free. They support pfSense and a list of other ASUS routers. And the ASUS routers, they give you the firmware for it. So you actually buy the ASUS router or any of the routers they have on their list, and you upload their firmware and it adds the functionality to the router. So the router gives them the visibility to your internal devices and then applies DNS rules to each device. Really clever.
It is really clever, and I heard what Steve Gibson talking about it.
Yeah.
And did he say that they use OpenDNS in the background?
Yes.
So what advantage do you have of this over using OpenDNS?
You can set filtering. For example, you can filter out naughty websites and all kinds of other lists on a per-device basis.
Who does that?
You're adding a front end port because you can use the free umbrella OpenDNS system. You don't have anything more than changing it for your entire network.
Yeah.
Now, the solution around that is you set the DNS for your network to OpenDNS. You add the filtering based on IP. And then you just use different DNS on your devices that you don't want filtered. It's not very granular. This is really granular. I'm going to do a review on it because I'm really impressed.
I wonder how they do that.
It's by MAC address.
By MAC address, right? On the plugin. And I'm going to do a whole video review on how it works. So it's pretty fascinating with it. There's a fun open source safe cracking thing that went on, and Wired did an article on it. And I have a link to the video. Basically, this guy's wife bought him a safe but didn't give him the accommodation because they knew what he would do, and which was build a Arduino bot to crack the safe. And he's got the whole methodology broke down and how it worked and how he did with the Arduino bot. So it was really clever. So that's the link to that video, just something novel to watch related to open source and building robotics. I also found this, and have you ever heard of this tool, Phil, called MONITORIX, monitorix.org.
No, but I've heard of Monit, the open source monitoring tool. What is Monitorix?
It's a really slick RRD collective graph that graphs all the log files in a very clever way with its own dedicated web server. So you just simply load it on the machine, point it, and does. I haven't tried it yet, but I just found it the other day, and it's on my to-do list because it keeps really nice historical logs of everything from CPU usage, wait times, and it does all kinds of monitoring of network traffic and anything you configure it to log, and it creates really cool, you know, running history RRD graphs.
So is this on a per-machine basis that this would be installed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, on a per-machine basis, so you can install it on a machine and kind of figure out, look at the history of the machine and figure out when it's time to upgrade it because its memory usage gets too high. This has been around a little while, but I think it's fun to play with. If you ever have to do regex and you're not sure why it's not matching something, there is a regexr.com. It is a live. You can paste whatever you want into the bottom of the web page, and at the top, as you type the regex commands, it highlights the things that you're finding, so you can interactively write your regex code and make sure it works.
Does it allow you to switch regex engines from like Perl compatible to Java?
All right. I believe it has all of them on there. you can play with it. It's definitely pretty slick. So that was my rundown news list. Those last two are just really helpful tools. But the regex, it's cool because it's all like a really slick HTML5 site. So as you're typing, it's just doing things. And yeah,
that is interesting. And in the example they have, the regex that's capital letters. You know, if it starts with a capital letter, then highlight, you know, that word, you know, to the end of that word. So you look through there, and it's only highlighting words that are more than one letter that's capitalized.
Yeah. I like it because they have lots of, and it tells you how many matches, and then you can paste whatever text you want in. So if you know what your text is that's going to be through there, and you know what you want to match, you can now dump it all in there and start writing it and interactively see it without, like I do, just keep guessing. Which command was this? Is it capital? Is it a plus I put here? Is it a W? I can't remember. Slash G? Which one is it?
Something that I find really super helpful are regex character classes. So let's say you're using grep or sed. There is something called the character class that lets you say, I only want the digits. But that way you don't have to remember like slash D or slash W or slash S for space. And there's a character class for alphanumeric numbers and just the alphabet and just funky characters like percent and ampersand and stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah, my biggest challenge with regex is I just don't use enough. I mean, I've got scripts that are using it, and I usually just go back and look at what I used to do. I look at some old script I got running that's working, and that's how I solve my next one. or I message Phil because, you know, his license plate is set awk, I think. So
yes.
I pulled up. I thought it was your vehicle, and as soon as I look at the license plate, I said yes, it Phil's. Is.
To get our backcountry camping permits, the lady. The DNR lady needed to know my license plate so they knew which cars not to tow overnight. And she's like, do you know your license plate? And I was so proud at that moment. I was like, yes, I do.
Yes, I do.
Said awk.
She said, what? Has anybody to whom you've given your plate number kind of laughed and, you know, like they knew exactly what was going on?
Only you guys.
It's okay. Driving yesterday, some guy, SCSI was his license.
Nice.
It's an old graveyard driving across.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me when I was coming back from, I was downtown Detroit, and there was a Jeep, and it was VMLINUZ, which is, I think, the compressed Linux kernel. Cool. I thought, oh, my God. Nice. I took a picture of it. It was kind of fun.
There's a guy at work that has network. Is his his last name, or his plate, his network.
Mm-hmm.
So. I need a
yeah. Plate so I could actually, I could get a license plate that would be AUX-SED.
You could.
Oh.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
For what did it cost you? $5 extra?
Like maybe $20 or something.
And you can go at any time. I mean, you can go online at any time and order a new plate.
Yes, you can. When I get bored, I go to the State of Michigan license plate generator to see what's available.
You know, I've done that too. I have done that too. Nice. That's very funny because I was looking for Linux or I was going to put FreeBSD or something, you know, something kind of fun on it like that.
In other news, if anybody follows cryptocurrency, just the other day, hackers stole $31 million worth of Ethereum coin. And then to protect other high profile targets, white hat hackers stole all the money out of those wallets to prevent the person who stole the initial $31 million from stealing up to $150 million. The white hat hackers did it in an automated fashion so that they could outpace the black hat hacker. And then they also kept an audit trail so they could give back all of the money to those wallets when the Ethereum project fixed the code. So the exploit was between a client called Parity and some Ethereum developers' code that allowed this attack to reset something inside of a wallet, to reinitialize a wallet to say, okay, you can take this these coins.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah.
My question is, do these guys ever have a chance to spend that money?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the guy, well, did we talk about him in the last show? The guy who got his, he lost $30,000.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this, we talked about it on the last show, and we'll bring you up to speed real quick here, Phil. There was a very, very specific virus on this computer. This virus has a single purpose, and it's when you copy and paste a Bitcoin wallet, it flips it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. But so these big hackers in Europe who are, you know, wherever they are, I'm not blaming Europe because they're everywhere, when they steal 50 million...
F.
Yeah, whatever. So they end up being able to take that out
because it's blockchain and it's infinite ledger, we can just follow where all the money went. And you'll follow it and you'll watch these guys transfer it from account to account. And eventually it lands on somewhere that's a exchange that they turned it into cash.
So that's their attempt to launder it.
Yes.
Laundering Bitcoin.
Yeah. Mm.
They can't really launder it, though, because there's a ledger that tracks it.
That's why you hit the exchanges. We turn it into another currency.
Oh, okay.
Wire it into Mt. Gox, wherever it might be, will take it and convert it to euros or whatever. And then they may not ever leave that bank. But that breaks.
That's how they sanitize it. It's not, I guess it is laundering. They take the money, you can track it, they take it into an exchange, and then there's so many in and outs of the exchange you don't know, and then they distribute it amongst other accounts somewhere else, either other blockchain accounts or literally go to the bank and take funds out.
Okay.
Yeah, so it becomes a very tricky system to deal with.
And then other than that, just like we get congestion, there is a new TCP congestion algorithm by Google. I think it's called TCP-BBR or TCP-BRR, something like that. It allows far better performance of TCP. Something else related is TCP Illinois. And I believe this is a kernel level thing. I wasn't too sure. I read it one morning on my honeymoon and then promptly forgot everything else about it.
Good job, honeymoon.
What? Okay.
Fair enough.
I was going to make some silly joke about running it on Open Indiana. What was this? TCP Illinois?
TCP Illinois. And that's the first thing that I thought of, too.
That's funny.
Oh, my gosh. Huh. Wow, that's some interesting stuff.
All right. Actually didn't get any news this week.
Well, I think we got you covered, Tony.
We got you covered.
Not a problem. And you're turning all the buttons over there anyway, you know, all the knobs and dials. So
trying to make sure everything's going right.
Yeah, you're doing a fine job.
A fine job.
So that can only mean one thing then.
Did you have a song?
Music. Oh.
Are we skipping it?
we could do the random Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, we're using that algorithm.
Okay.
That's right. Okay.
I need to get to it first. Hold on.
Okay. He's over there madly typing.
The outgoing music for this week's show.
It's a quick, it's the intro, but it's so fast I don't get to type it out. So Nine Inch Nails is on, what's it?
Not Jimendo, no.
Where do we post our shows to? Where's the download?
SMLR.us?
No. The actual, file, where we put it to. I haven't done it in so long. I can't think of the...
Tommy's looking at you.
Who's our file host?
Sorry, YouTube.
Where do we put our files for our SMLR shows?
/home/SMLR.
Archive.org?
Archive.org.
Oh, I'm sorry. Archive. Okay.
I
came up with the answer.
You did, Mary. Yes. Thank you.
I didn't understand the question. They're on my computer. I don't know. Back up.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Archive. That's where they all end up.
All right. So, let's see. Who wants to... What's the command line to grab a random number?
You can...
Is it random?
tail-n1 of /dev/urandom. You can pipe something through SHA-256 sum.
It's just got really long.
There's a lot of ways. I usually just Google it. Sorry.
That is a great answer.
That is legit.
But for our new Microsoft overlords, I usually just Bing it.
Oh, yeah.
No. Oh,
nobody does that. You know, it's one of my favorite memes. You know, there's a cancer institute unrelated to Microsoft called the Bing Cancer Institute, and someone has it captioned. It says, "I'm sorry, I don't think they'll ever find a cure." Just like this. Oh. I'm like, that's horrible. Oh. But I laughed.
All right. We're ready to go.
Okay.
Well, it's are we?
Track 36.
I got an email from Bing, speaking of Bing, before you go. Yeah. And it was funny because it was from Bing, and it was to me, and it says, you can't, and by the way, too, you know, I do my email as text. I do not do HTML email, just for obvious reasons. And then, so they apparently have embed this little comment in there for people who do this by saying, you can't see this awesome email because you haven't turned on HTML. And I said, you're darn right I haven't turned it on. And it was just simply a Bing email.
Are we ready?
I think so. I think Tony's ready.
All right. So random number came up with 36. So track 36 of Nine Inch Nails Ghosts 1 through 4. Track 36 is number 18 of Ghosts 2. Thank you.
listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review.
This was episode
242.
Reformed.
Reformed, that's right.
That's right. No blank stares at this end. All right.
This is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
Phil Parada.
And Tom Lawrence.
See you next time.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.